We once again welcome you back to the Cult It or Can It podcast. My guest host for this evening will be...
Nick. Hello, Zach.
And Nick, it's nice to have you back on the podcast.
It's great to be back.
You are a valued member of the cult crew.
Yeah, I'm pretty awesome.
And Nick, I'm going to need your help to navigate through the quagmire that is 1991's Highlander 2, The Quickening.
There could be only one unless there's a sequel.
There can be only one, and there should have been only one. Highlander 2 is directed by Russell Mulcahy. He's an Australian film director who also directed the first Highlander film. I think he directed Resident Evil Extinction, I believe, which came out in 2007.
Possibly. I have absolutely no idea.
He is a journeyman director. He'll basically direct any project he's been given. You know how sometimes when a big budget film comes out, the Sci-Fi Channel is right there to make a knockoff?
Yeah, the Asylum crew.
Like, I think that they did it for I Am Legend. There was one for I Am Legend, and it was like I Am Awesome or something.
Transmorphers.
Transmorphers, yeah, that's a famous one. And then they do a lot of like the Boa versus Python type crap.
Hey, Oscar worthy.
Well, Russell Mulcahy made a knockoff version of The Mummy around the time Brendan Fraser's Mummy was released into theaters. So he has that going for him, too.
Didn't he also make a knockoff version of Seven?
I imagine that he probably did. He also,
which I think also starred Christopher Lambert.
I think that he also directs music videos as well. And I think that like any time a director got his start directing music videos, he's almost never a good director.
You know, the odd thing about that, I'm looking him up on online right now. He directed several episodes of the critically acclaimed series Queer as Folk. So go figure.
So how do you go from Highlander to Queer as Folk?
TV's a step down from movies, but I guess in his case it might be a step sideways. I don't know.
Well, it's a paycheck.
Yeah, I mean, he can't complain. He directed the pilot as well, so maybe it was cheap to get a cheap director for a new TV series.
He works for union fees, I guess.
Yeah. But he also made Scorpion 2, Rise of the Warrior. So yeah.
All right, he's got that going for him. Well, at any rate, Russell Mulcahy is terrible. He's an awful director, as demonstrated in the first Highlander, which is not that bad of a movie, but it's not the classic that... Highlander is not a bad movie, but it is not the classic that everybody says that it is.
No, it definitely has its moments, but yeah, it's definitely a cult film.
It's awesomely bad. And this film is like awesomely terribly bad, if that makes any sense. We're talking about Highlander 2, The Quickening. It's from 1991. It stars Christopher Lambert, who once again comes back to play the part of Connor MacLeod, the immortal Scottish Highlander of the title. It also stars in a fairly hilarious supporting role, Sean Connery. And we also have Virginia Madsen and Michael Ironside. Michael Ironside, shock, plays a villain. Michael Ironside is probably best known for his villainous turn in the Arnold Schwarzenegger and Paul Verhoeven vehicle, Total Recall. And he pops up in other movies as well, such as Starship Troopers, Scanners. What else is he? But he's been in a million things. He was on Smallville.
Yeah, he played Lois Lane's dad on a couple episodes of Smallville.
He is a fairly well-known character actor. He's pretty popular on the internet. I think he does voiceover work as well. I think he's the voice of Max or Sam Fisher or whatever. Sam Fisher from the Splinter Cell video games. So he's fairly well-known. I say that Sean Connery's supporting role in this is hilarious. We'll get to that. I'm sure we will talk at length about that. Let's take a bit of time to talk about the production history of this film, because the way that this film was thrown together is actually interesting and hilarious.
That's definitely for sure. They should have a whole chapter in filmmaking classes strictly on this movie.
Agreed. This should be like what not to do, the Highlander 2 story. We should say right off the bat that there are like six different versions of this film. So if there's something wrong with our plot description, don't hold it against us, because we've probably both seen entirely different versions of the movie. There's the theatrical cut, there's the European theatrical cut, there's the Renegade version, there's the 2004 special edition DVD.
There's the television version.
The television version. Exactly. So there are a million things. And we should also say that Highlander 2 is completely ignored by the Highlander canon.
It seems like every subsequent sequel is ignored by the Highlander canon. And in some ways, so is the first film.
Let's just say this. We can summarize Highlander 2 by saying this. Did you ever watch a movie and really enjoy it, and then they made a sequel to it? Or this goes for television shows as well, like season by season. And they make something new in it, and they completely disregard and ignore the events of what happened in the earlier installment. I mean, that totally pisses me off. I mean, think back to like Saved by the Bell, when all of a sudden you have the character named Tori out of nowhere. Like, who the fuck is Tori? It's like they fired Elizabeth Berkley and Tiffany Amber Thiessen or something, and they replaced her with Tori, and there was never any explanation. Well, Highlander 2 is the film version of that.
The Highlander 2 movie, according to stuff I've read, they were already planning a sequel when Highlander 1 came out. Like, Christopher Lambert and Sean Connery signed like a contract to do two of them or something.
And Highlander 1 was released in 1986. This film was released in 1991, so that's a 5-year gap.
Yeah. The way, for those of you who out there who have not seen Highlander 1, hopefully you have, because this podcast would make a, well, quote unquote, make more sense. The first one ends with a definitive ending that would make any sequels playing into the strengths of the first one very difficult, especially using Sean Connery's character who dies before the story proper of the first Highlander movie.
At the end of the first Highlander movie, Connor McLeod wins. I don't think it's a spoiler. The movie is like 24 years old at this point. Connor McLeod wins the Highlander Challenge, wherein he defeats the last of the immortals. He is thus given the choice to like become a superpowered superhero dude and live forever, or regain his humanity and be able to like have children and pass on. When this movie starts out, and again there are different versions of this film, when this movie starts out, the version I saw, he is still debating whether or not he is going to choose the prize. Like it's the year 2024, so it's been like 40 years since he last defeated his major enemy, who was known as the Kurgan. It's 40 years later, and he still hasn't made a decision. He is like this completely feeble old man, and it's totally ridiculous because he's like walking around, and people are afraid of him. There's a group of thugs that are like, "Oh, hey, that's McLeod. Oh, back off. We can't rob him. We can't steal his car." Like, what is this old guy gonna do?
The sequel starts with Connor McLeod as an old man. And I think each version pretty much starts the same way with that. He seems to be this like scared guy by, like you said, thugs and that old hag that he meets in a bar that like throws a bottle over his head. It's never quite explained why he's feared, other than he was involved with the whole.
Let me read the synopsis of the plot that I wrote to try and make sense of what we're talking about. If you're confused by this, it's okay, because I've seen this movie probably 5 or 6 times, and it's still confusing because it's so incoherent. But basically, it's the year 2024. The first film takes place in 1986, so again, we're about 40 years in the future. The world is recovering from a catastrophic ozone depletion. Connor McLeod, who is now an old man, he struggles with his old age and this constant decision of whether or not he should accept the mysterious prize that he earned when he was in his youth. Again, these were the events that comprised the first movie. Now, as he weighs this decision, he remembers an event that took place in his past where he was a member of a rebellion, and he was aided by his friend named Juan Sanchez Villalobos Ramirez, and that's Sean Connery's character. None of this is explained in the first movie whatsoever. Meanwhile, on the planet Zeist, for some reason, the angry General Katana, yes, his name is General Katana, despite the fact that they're on a different planet, and theoretically the word Katana should not exist, summons two minions to leap into the future somehow of planet Earth and to kill McLeod for some reason that's never clearly explained. So when McLeod kills these two generic thugs, again, for unknown reasons, he regains his youthful looks as well as his power. It never says that he accepts the prize. And then also, for some godforsaken reason, he yells out the name Ramirez. Again, that's the name of his friend, played by Sean Connery. And this, again, for no explainable reason, brings Sean Connery back to life. We should note that at this point, Ramirez had probably been dead for 300 years. And when he comes back, he mysteriously appears on a stage during a staging of Hamlet or Macbeth or something, and his clothes are completely fine. He is completely clean. He's not covered with dirt or anything. It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. While all of this is going on, evil corporate executive, played by John C. McGinley, a.k.a. Dr. Cox from Scrubs, attempts to continue his evil S.H.I.E.L.D. Corporation's cruel practice of charging people money to live. Why does this subplot exist? displeased with his minions, General Katana travels to Earth himself in order to kill McCloud, again for reasons which are unclear. These events ultimately lead Connor to destroying the shield, dispatching his nemesis, and living happily ever after with Virginia Madsen. There is no reason whatsoever for this film to exist. Nothing makes sense.
I think you mixed a couple of the versions in there, but honestly, your story makes more sense than what was presented in any of the versions.
This is a movie that is so bad that the director walked out after 15 minutes of the premiere.
And not just any director, Russell McCauley.
Now, what happened with this film? Because The First Highlander, while not a great film, is a decent action film, a nice little cult genre film that makes sense, it's fun to watch, it's got some fun performances, it's got some humor, it's got some good action scenes. What went wrong?
I've heard a couple of different things on this.
Please elaborate.
I will do my best, because it's been a while since I read this stuff, to see if I can help. From what I heard, there was a lot of budgeting problems. If memory serves, they were filming in Argentina, and they were constantly going over budget for, I think, a variety of different reasons. And it got to the point where they needed to put a movie out. They were fearing that this movie was not going to recover its losses. And essentially, once all the filming was done, the studio suits came in and re-edited the movie to what they thought would be the quote-unquote most profitable. And that was the original theatrical version of Highlander 2, The Quickening, which features the immortals coming from a planet called Zeist, which still contradicts the stuff from the first film, and subsequently plot elements come from that area. Later on, Russell McCauley was very upset after all he walked out in the first of the movie, and was somehow allowed to re-edit the movie to what his original vision was.
Now, did he or did he not also shoot additional scenes for the movie? Because I've heard that he had done that.
I heard that as well. I have no reason to not believe it. It just seems very odd that extra money would go into a movie of this caliber.
We should say this. The original film was nowhere near a box office success. It grossed $5 million. Why was this movie made?
My guess is, I'm sure people online could find out more, that I think it probably had a good video release and it proved popular probably among college-age kids, which is, let's face it, probably this movie's target audience. Kind of like when you have DVD sales that are popular today, brings back TV shows like Futurama, Family Guy, and Firefly fans were able to get their Serenity movie, that I'm guessing it just proved that, hey, there's an audience for this.
There's a difference, though, because the things that you all just named, Family Guy, Futurama, Firefly, and Serenity, all of those programs have some modicum of quality, whether you like them or not. And this film is just terrible. I have this thing.
I'm talking about in reference. Oh, I thought you were asking like why Highlander 2 was made. I was talking about in reference to like the first Highlander.
It's really more of a rhetorical question than anything.
Oh. Sorry.
That's okay. This film comes 5 years after the original film. I have this personal thing. If a film is released more than 3 years, if a sequel to a film is released more than 3 years after the original, it's going to suck. And there are only a few movies out there that have proven me wrong. And the one that I can think of off the top of my head is 2010, because I like 2010. And really, that's about it. Both the Matrix movies sucked, the Matrix sequels. I'm sorry, I'm going to probably draw the ire of 1,000 people out there, but both of the Back to the Future sequels were inferior to the original. Ghostbusters 2 is inferior to the original. Don't even get me started on Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Hey, I like that movie.
You're the only person in America.
Hey, it got a 70-some-odd% on Rotten Tomatoes. That's good enough, damn it.
I know, and see, that's funny. I love the way that people will originally give a movie a review, a positive review, and then after the public rejects it, the reviewers will change their opinion. I mean, that's just total hilarity. That's neither here nor there. I walked out of that film feeling like I had been cheated. I'm not going to lie.
Well, you're just not a true fan.
Let me ask you a question, Nick. Let's say that Russell Mulcahy, that last name is hard to pronounce, had complete creative control. It was never wrestled away from him. Does he make a good movie?
No.
You just reminded me of that time when we were watching Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
All right, we don't have to say it then. We'll keep it a secret. Sean Connery's performance in this film is basically like a half-hour comic relief.
Hey, Zach, can we pause on that? I'd like to expand on my no comment, if
Oh,
that's okay.
sure, go ahead.
The reason I say no is this movie, regardless of what version you watch, because I think the Renegade version, which it tends to be the most common version you can find now, is Russell McCauley's preferred version. And let's face it, all the stuff he wanted to film was filmed, regardless if he wanted to take like an extra scene here or there. The story was in place. And the story between the two different versions, there are a lot of differences, but overall, a lot of it is the same. And the story is not good. As you mentioned earlier, it contradicts stuff that's in the first movie. A lot of the stuff that happens in Highlander 2 is very, it makes no sense. It just happens for the sake of happening. It's not a good movie, regardless if the director was able to do what he wanted. The story was not happening.
Now, the first movie, the setting of the first movie largely takes place in New York City. I mean, there are other settings like France and Great Britain and Scotland and so forth, but it largely takes place in New York City, and some of it, not all of it, but some of it was filmed in New York City. In the second film, they're still supposed to be in New York, but it does not look like New York at all. There are no landmarks. It's very obvious that it was filmed for the cheap in some South American country, which I think was Argentina, as you mentioned earlier. I noticed something hilarious as I was watching this for the podcast. They get in the car and they drive to the Shield Corporation, which is supposedly in the desert, and they're there in like 20 minutes because we all know that New York is located right next to the desert.
It's the future.
Let me ask you a question. Connor McLeod is one of the people who helped create the powerful machine that blocks out the sun so that the people on Earth can live. Let me,
Yes.
okay, so how does Connor McLeod design and create this powerful machine when he has no engineering or scientific background whatsoever?
Well, I'll defend the movie on this point. We really don't know what Connor McLeod's background is. Keep in mind, he has been alive for 500 some odd years. Who knows what knowledge he's picked up, but I will grant you that they don't go into it. He just mysteriously knows this stuff.
I mean, in the first movie, he's an antiques dealer. So apparently, between antiquing and cutting off the heads of warriors from the Russian steppes, he managed to get his engineering degree from MIT.
Possibly after why am I trying to defend this movie? Never mind.
Sean Connery's performance is basically comic relief. He received something like $3 million for 9 days of work. And I just want to point out, this came at a low point in Connery's career. People don't often remember that, but like from the early 80s until about the early 90s or so, there was a good 10-year period where Sean Connery was not a respected Hollywood actor. And he was in The Untouchables, and that was about the high point of that 10 years for him.
Well, he was also in the third Indiana Jones movie, which seems to be a high point as well.
Yeah.
I think that's when his career was starting to rebound anyway.
His career was rebounding. This obviously seems like such a step back. It just makes me think that he had to have been contractually obligated to do something like this.
I mean, I hate saying this because I know your listeners are going to be like, post a link or it didn't, it's not real. But when I think the third Highlander movie was coming out, that they were talking about the first one and that Sean Connery and Christopher Lambert were contracted for two films. Oh, so he was contracted to do it.
We should talk a little bit about Juan Sanchez Villalobos Ramirez. Largely a comic relief supporting role from Sean Connery. I will say this. He is resurrected at the beginning of the film. I swear, it must take a good 45 minutes before he and Christopher Lambert are reunited. And
It
then they
does take a while.
spend all of maybe 15 minutes together, and then he dies again.
Or he gets enveloped by a light. I kind of don't understand what's going on with that.
That is the most awesomely bad scene. So Ramirez uses his Egyptian, Spanish, Scottish powers to stop a whirling fan of mechanistic death. So while he's doing this, he's standing there like he's kind of crouched and he's holding his hand in the air and there's like a white/blue energy ball in his hand for some reason. And then all of a sudden the door where they're because they're trapped in this room, the door mysteriously pops open. It's never explained.
Short Ron must have hit the button.
So Connor and Virginia Madsen are able to escape. Ramirez could have just gone right with them. He was 5 feet from the door. So then, for some reason, Ramirez explodes into a ball of white light, and the entire scene is set to Amazing Grace on the bagpipes.
It worked in Star Trek too.
Sean Connery is Scottish, all right? He's well known for being Scottish. In this movie, he's playing an Egyptian Spaniard. It's awesome.
I will say, I will defend the movie on this. I think Sean Connery's parts before he meets Christopher Lambert are genuinely funny. Like, I love the sequence when he's on the airplane, and it's the first time he's ever on an airplane because he's stepped from, like, 1555 or something to 2024, and so he's on, like, a flying machine, and this is, like, weird for him. And I love the completely over-the-top safety video.
Oh, right. Which actually shows, like, the cabin depressurizing.
And the plane, like, going down and exploding. And it's just, like, the worst video that would ever be shown. And it's incredibly stupid, but I think Sean Connery's reaction to it saves that scene from being completely dumb. I think it becomes genuinely funny at that point.
That's because, let's be honest here, Sean Connery is the only respectable actor in the movie. I mean, say what you will. I know Virginia Madison, or whatever her name is. I know that Virginia Madison was nominated for an Academy Award. Okay, I know that. It was for Sideways, all right? It's not exactly a film that's really held up in the following years. I know that Michael Ironside has an internet cult devoted to him. He's never really acted in anything of value. And I know that Christopher Lambert used to bone Diane Lane. That's probably the best thing that he's ever done. And I know that John C. McGinley is funny on Scrubs as Dr. Cox. But again, he's more known for being John Cusack's friend than for doing anything he's done on TV or in movies. So Sean Connery seems to be the only one here who has any clue what he's doing and what this movie is going to be. He's winking at the audience. He's cracking one-liners, probably things that weren't even in the script. But since he's Sean Connery, the director can't exactly tell him no.
It's true.
So he is the high point of this movie.
I'll agree with you on all points concerning all the other actors on that. Like, but yeah, Sean Connery's like the gem in this otherwise pile of crap.
There's an old saying, you can't polish a turd. And no matter how many times Russell Mulcahy goes back and tries to edit this film into a workable, serviceable, coherent movie, you just can't do it. You can't do it. Because there are scenes in this movie, again, that just make absolutely no sense whatsoever when you compare them to the first film. I mean, nothing was ever explained about how the Highlander and about how Sean Connery had this mysterious past together where they fought against General Katana, who's not even Asian. It doesn't fit together. How the hell can General Katana know so much about American culture when he's from a completely different planet? Like, at one point, he beats up a guy and says something like, don't mess with your number one draft choice or something like that. How does he know what that is?
Well, in one of the versions, he does have, like, an awesome TV screen where he could watch, like, life.
Now, Nick, we've talked about this movie at length, and you told me something interesting one time, and I always fuck it up, so maybe you'll get it right. But you said that basically he is in the past. General Katana is in the past. He's watching what's going on in the future. Like, do you remember what I'm getting at?
I think so, yeah.
How did you explain this? Try and explain it.
This is the thing that doesn't make sense. In version A of the movie, where planet Zeist exists, let me explain something. In the two versions, in the Quickening version and the Renegade version being the director's preferred cut, where the Immortals come from are two different places. In the original version, they come from this planet called Zeist, and as time goes on in the movie, time is continuing in Zeist. So when it's like 2024 on Earth, it's 2024 on Zeist. In the preferred cut of the director, the Renegade version, General Katana is all in the far distant past, which makes no sense to begin with, and I'll go on that in a moment. And he sends like the bad immortals from his point of view, like Connor McCloud and
Sean
Ramirez,
Connery.
Yeah, and Sean Connery, and sends them to the future for like punishment. This makes no sense in any shape, way, or form. Why do you send them to the future? But that's neither here nor there. Second version of the movie, he's watching Connor McCloud. He's keeping tabs on him because he and McCloud were mortal enemies. He wants to make sure that McCloud does not win the prize to come back to the past and challenge him. He has, like, a viewer, like this holographic TV screen where he's watching the future. Why doesn't he know that eventually his quote-unquote civilization is going to fall or use, like, his future television to foretell things that are a little bit more pressing? If Connor McCloud is in the future, can't he just like channel up to find out eventually what his decisions are going to be and whether or not he needs to like face him, or can't he, you know, channel down to like a year or two from General Katana's point of view to see what's going to happen? He has a television to the damn future. Can't he see what's going to happen?
It makes absolutely zero sense whatsoever. Much has been made of the fact that there is no motivation for any character in this film at all. Why does General Katana care about killing Connor McLeod when Connor McLeod is basically, at the beginning of the film, 2 weeks away from dying of old age?
The only if they kept the idea, regardless of how stupid it is, of the immortals being from the planet Zeist, which is timeline, same time that's going on as stuff on Earth, it would have made at least a little more sense. But no, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Let me drop some truth bombs on you here, okay? This is from Wikipedia. I thought this was hilarious. One of the most unusual running jokes of the film is the disappearing and reappearing swords. In Highlander, in the first one, when Connor meets and trains with Ramirez, Ramirez uses an ancient katana, which is completely anachronistic, while McLeod uses a Scottish claymore. When Ramirez dies, McLeod takes the katana and he stabs his own claymore into the earth to kind of like denote like this was the homeland of Connor McLeod, and then he like leaves all emo-ish. So Ramirez's katana is his only sword for the next 500 years, and we know this because in the first movie, the love interest takes like a sliver of the metal from the sword and is able to like carbon date it, and she's all fascinated by it.
Because it's like significantly older than it when it should be.
Right, it's anachronistic.
Yeah.
So when Ramirez is brought back from the dead in Highlander 2, for some reason he's wielding a Scottish sword. He never shows any surprise whatsoever at having the different blade. And then in the director's cut, or Renegade version, which is probably the version that most people have seen, Ramirez, he takes this sword from a stage set. Nevertheless, after 2,000 years of using a two-handed weapon, he is able to use the single-handed weapon without any training whatsoever. So when he and McLeod fight in McLeod's apartment in this movie, no one makes any comments about the sword. Shouldn't he say, "Wow, that's my old katana. Hey, can I have that back? Here, I'll trade you for this one." Nor does he inquire about it. I'm done. It's probably worth like millions of dollars because it was one of a kind. Only one was ever made.
Yeah.
And it was so special because in the first movie, he talks about getting the sword from the father of the last wife that he took, and about how her death was so awful, and about how McLeod should never take on a wife so that he never has to suffer through that. And it meant so much to him. And it means nothing in this movie whatsoever.
Or if it did, they certainly don't go over it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, who knows? Maybe there was a scene planned for it and it was cut for time or something from the...
You assume too much.
Yeah, I think that I do. I think we've completely exhausted how awful this movie is. So one of the things that we do here at the Cult or Can It podcast is we ultimately decide whether or not we should cult or can a film. And I think at this point everybody knows what that means, and if you don't know what it means, I'd direct you to the website. You can find out there. Nick, I'm going to can the hell out of this movie. I think that it is probably the worst sequel ever made. I don't think that any amount of tinkering by the director or by the producers or by fans or anything is ever going to make this a coherent, logical, watchable, serviceable film. There are things that I enjoy about this movie on a completely ironic level. The badness of the directing, the terrible performances, the mugging and winking for the camera. I can enjoy all those things. If you like movies that are awesomely bad and you haven't seen this, you owe it to yourself to check it out.
You know what? I have to say, even though I think there's a lot of interesting stuff they tried to do in the movie, I think the future setting wasn't a bad idea to at least make it a little different from like the first one. I think the whole eco-terrorist plot was an interesting side thing, even though it was hardly developed at all. What it was and what was developed was very, very poor. And I also have to say, if this wasn't a Highlander movie and it was its own sort of independent sort of flick with no connections to Highlander whatsoever, it might be actually kind of serviceable and somewhat enjoyable on the way the first Highlander movie was. But because it has that connection, it drops it, unfortunately, a number of points. I, too, will have to can this movie. It's not good. It's just ridiculously bad.
No final thoughts. We're done. So if you have enjoyed this podcast, please visit our website at http://cultitorcanit.blogspot.com. Please feel free to leave us some suggestions. You can follow us on iTunes. We have a link there for an RSS feed. The episodes will download automatically when they come out. We are at the point now where we are releasing around one episode per week. We are in our, third or fourth month of existence. I think we have maybe 15 or 16 shows up. We're getting up there, and we're very slowly and very steadily making some progress. So we hope that you've enjoyed our podcasts. I ask that you please keep listening. I'm always looking for suggestions. I'm always looking for co-hosts. So if you'd like to be a part of the Cultured or Canon podcast, please drop us an email. The email is on the site. You can also contact us through Facebook. I'm always constantly pimping my website through Facebook. So for my co-host, Nick, I am your host, Zach, and I say thank you for listening to the podcast.